I think what has clearly been shown that if you add biotics, you change the gastrointestinal microbiota in a positive way. Whether that has a clinical benefit or not can be debated, because it depends also on how strict you are before making recommendations.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series exploring the latest evidence on biotics and gastrointestinal applications. In this series, we speak with experts about some of the latest published reviews that cover evidence on the safety and efficacy of probiotics and prebiotics for clinically relevant gastrointestinal symptoms and outcomes.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the ISAP Science, Microbes and Health podcast series. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Gabriel Vignarolo, who joins us from Argentina. And today we have a very special guest, Professor Ivan van den Plas, who's joining us from Belgium. Ivan van den Plas did his medical studies at the Free University of Brussels and trained in pediatrics at the same university. He went on to become head of the Unit for Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition in 1987 and created the pediatric hospital, the Kids Health Castle, at the University Hospital of Brussels at the same university, where he became chair of pediatrics from 1994 to 2021. He is now Professor Emeritus and continues as a consultant at the same hospital and also serves as Associate Editor of Nutrients. Ivan, welcome today to the podcast.
My pleasure.
Now, you have a long history of working on biotics in the area of infant nutrition and infant formula and infant feeding. Can you give us kind of a general overview of where this situation is at the moment with supplementing infant formula with biotics of various types?
Well, I think that probably the most important evolution in infant formula over the last 20 years is that everyone became very well aware that microbiota is very important, and that in formula-fed infants, that gastrointestinal microbiota was totally different from the microbiota from breastfed infants. And then the story started to add biotics to infant formula in order to try to get that gastrointestinal microbiota of those formula-fed infants closer to that of breastfed infants. So that's what happened over the last 20 years, and it's still amazing that it took so long before people realized that the third most important component in mother's milk, the human milk oligosaccharides, which are the prebiotics, which are the biotics stimulated at healthy microbiota, that was virtually absent in cow's milk and thus virtually absent in infant formula.
Absolutely.
Ivan, it's a privilege to have you here today, because you have been like a witness in the development of how infant formula got much more sophisticated from the 80s, from the 90s to what we have today. And one of the components beyond probiotics, prebiotics or postbiotic are HMOs, human milk oligosaccharides. And we know that in human milk, we have around 200 HMOs have been described. And for today, maybe you will let us know 4, 5, 6 HMO have been produced and added. Do you think that would be is enough? Maybe there is a core of HMOs that are needed there? Or where are we heading with this development?
Yeah, very good question. And first of all, I think that within our ESGRIM group and also in agreement with the EFSA, the European Food Safety Authority, the HMOs that are added to infant formula, we should call them different, I think, HIMOs or HEMOs, human identical milk oligosaccharide, just to make it very clear to the consumer mainly, that they are not coming from mother's milk, although they are completely identical. But I think that on the other side, HMOs have become so popular and so used in daily life that HMOs will also be used still. Now, I think there are two different aspects, I think. One is those 200 HMOs in mother's milk. We don't know if they are really necessary. Maybe 120 would do also the job. So that's what nature does. But is it really, are they all important for infant health? It's absolutely not known. So from that point of view, maybe it's not necessary to add 200. On the other side, probably if you are focusing on microbiome composition into the smallest detail, that then you might need them to in order to get to more similar microbiota. But is that important for the clinical aspects? No one really knows. I think today what we can do is add the three kinds of human milk oligosaccharides from the three different families, the CL-related ones and the fucosylated and the third group. But on the other side, they are also all short chain, while in mother's milk, there are also long chain oligosaccharides. And again, is that clinically important or not? Not very clear. And then the next question is the amount of oligosaccharides to be added, because it's also very changing their content in mother's milk, going from around 12 grams per liter in the very early milk to 4 grams per liter when the baby is 1 year old. So does that have to change all the time? On the other side, what we see is that by adding two of those oligosaccharides at much lower levels than those in human milk, you see already a very positive effect on the gastrointestinal microbiota composition of those babies. So I think there is probably, it depends on how you look at it. From the scientific point of view, the composition point of view, then it's absolutely that 6 is very different from 200, and we have a long way to go. On the other side, if you look at it from the pure clinical aspects, which might be clinically relevant, you see already very positive effects, as I said, with 2 at much lower amount in mother's milk. So it's not also demonstrated that we need exactly what is in mother's milk to have clinically similar effects on that gastrointestinal microbiota of the infants and clinically similar health benefits.
I want to take you up on that, and I want you to talk a little bit about the clinical endpoints that are important. We know from the literature that the rates of gastrointestinal infections, etc., are lower in breastfed babies than in formerly fed babies, which are unsupplemented. What clinical outcomes or clinical endpoints are achievable with supplementation of formula with biotics, prebiotics, and probiotics?
Yeah, again, a very good question. And has been shown in literature, but it are very frequently associations and very frequently also not primary endpoint of clinical trials. And let me start to answer differently. I think what has clearly been shown that if you add biotics, you change the gastrointestinal microbiota in a positive way. Whether that has a clinical benefit or not can be debated, because it depends also on how strict you are before making recommendations. On the other side, what seems, at least in a lot of clinical trials, is that the addition of probiotics or prebiotics or human milk oligosaccharides tend to decrease the rate of infectious diseases, tend to decrease the prescription rate of antibiotics. Now, it's true that the world of the adding of those biotics to infant formula is changing so rapidly, and that if your preliminary condition is that you need two similar clinical trials in order to demonstrate a benefit and to make a recommendation, that world is changing so rapidly that, yeah, when one trial is finished, it's already changing because new biotics can be added to the infant formula. So the hard evidence with decrease of infections, decrease of antibiotic prescriptions as primary endpoint of these clinical trials is missing. On the other side, you have 20 clinical trials who all show that there is an association, a tendency. Every study shows the same. There is that trend to decrease the infections, to decrease the antibiotic prescriptions. And there is never a negative result. Not one clinical trial suggested that you might have more infections, that you might have more antibiotic prescriptions. So I think for me, that's enough clinical evidence to say that the addition of biotics to infant formula are very, very, very likely to have a clinical benefit.
Ivan, you recently you were the responsible of a very, very huge work published in Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition about recommendations of clinical relevant endpoints. And it seems that so far you were in favor of the recommendation for soft feces, not more than that. I think that maybe that is because many studies use the combination of FOS and GOS. But when it comes to probiotics, the strains are very different. So maybe there is no recommendation for probiotic or for biotic because the strains were different. Do you think that you can go in a case-to-case indication of probiotic, or there is no way to recommend any probiotic for any clinical relevant condition?
Well, first of all, you might question yourself how relevant the observation of softer stools and more frequent defecation is in non-constipated infants, because it's all demonstrated in healthy infants. What is missing is to demonstrate that effect in constipated infants, because that trial, again, has not really been done. And those recommendations from the Esquim group are the consequence of the fact that in order to make a recommendation, it was said that there was a need for at least two similar clinical trials with the same kind of design, with the same biotic studied. And that's true that with FOS and GOS, there have been a lot of studies. So there you can make at least that recommendation, because that was in many of those trials the primary outcome. Because again, the weakness of a lot of those trials is that the real clinical relevant outcomes, such as we said, less infections, less antibiotics, that was not a primary outcome from those studies. They were not powered enough to demonstrate that with certainty. And so if you're not certain, you cannot make the recommendation. The same is true for the probiotics. I think so many different probiotics have been studied, and again, they all show some benefit, but there are not two very similar trials. And then again, you cannot end up with active recommendations. And that's partly related to, in fact, the only people who are investigating in this kind of research is the formula industry. And they are, of course, interested in rapid benefit and changes and not really wanting to follow those clinicians who want two clinical trials. They are very happy with one clinical trial showing some secondary outcome with benefit and use that. So I think one of the issues is that there should be, what would be much better is that this kind of trials would be done by independent funding and independent researchers, and now it's always it's a win-win, certainly for the industry. But on the other side, if you would not have them, the infant formula would still be as 30 years ago. So it's thanks to the industry that all those advantages have become true. So it's the win-win at this moment, but at least we are fully aware that this is not the ideal situation, because you're always dependent on commercial end goals of the industry, which is also logic. I mean, they do only do clinical trials to have a commercial benefit. But on the other side, our infants benefit from it, because we can not neglect that the composition of infant formula today is much better than that of 20 years ago.
Now, in the recommendations that Gabor just mentioned to you, what endpoints did you and your group feel were most important for future studies?
Well, actually, within the group, we are starting now, under the leadership of Anja Sajewska, to think about a paper just highlighting this, what we want, what would be the best clinical outcomes. But it's obviously that clinically relevant outcomes are for those infants the most important. So it's, as we already said, it's most about, I think, what is easiest to show is decrease of infectious diseases, respiratory tract infections, gastroenteritis, as a consequence of that decrease of antibiotic use. The benefit on the long term on less allergy, less immune-mediated diseases, because if you have a well-balanced gastrointestinal tract, in theory, you have a good development of your immune system. You should have a decrease of immune-mediated diseases, but that becomes much more difficult, because then you have a time lapse of 10 years or 15 years, while less gastroenteritis, less respiratory infections, that's immediate benefit. That's within the weeks, months that the trial is going on. Eventually, you follow up for 2-3 years, and you show that there is even a benefit for a short period after the stopping the administration of those biotics. But these are, I think, the kind of clinical trials which we really need to be performed. And then the question is, where do you do that? Probably the easiest way to do that is in countries where there is a high prevalence of infections, because in the Western world, the prevalence of infections in young babies is relatively low, also because of all the vaccinations. And then you would need probably thousands of babies to show the difference. So go to a country where there is still high prevalence of infectious diseases would then be, I think, a good option to show this benefit on these primary outcomes, which are really clinically relevant. And then you can translate that also to the industrialized world.
That, like the study that was done in India some time ago with the Commons Group having probiotic, where they show changes in mortality and very significant endpoints.
Yes, there are here and there some trials showing that. And that's why I think that is really the most relevant clinical outcome to be demonstrated.
The other point you made there, which is a very interesting one, which was an area of a lot of interest a few years ago, is the idea of giving probiotics to the mother and then looking for changes in, you mentioned autoimmune disease. I think eczema was a particular focus, and allergic diseases in the infant going forward with time. You mentioned the obvious problem with that. You need longitudinal studies with long-term follow-up. Is there still an interest in that area?
Well, I think I would respond to you in a different way. I think there is not enough attention to that composition of mother's milk and the richness of mother's milk in those human milk oligosaccharides, or the importance of the gastrointestinal microbiota composition of that mother at the moment of giving birth, during the last month of pregnancy and at the moment of birth. Because a lot of those mothers do receive antibiotics. A lot of those mothers get proton pump inhibitors. We all know that has an impact on the gastrointestinal microbiota composition. But no one ever looked at the impact of that on the baby. So that's certainly an area which needs, I think, further research. And then, yes, of course, the administration of biotics, probiotics to a pregnant woman might be beneficial because you restore that healthy gastrointestinal microbiome, which is very important for that baby. That's why vaginally born babies have a different microbiome than cesarean section born babies also. So that first colonization seems to be very important. And in fact, we neglect the composition of the perianal and gastrointestinal microbiota of the mother at the moment of delivery. That's not enough a focus of the research, probably because the one is the area of the gynecologist and the other is the area of the pediatrician, and there is insufficient collaboration between those two doctors.
Ivan, I don't work with children, but I meet many, many pediatricians, and some of them I hear related to infant colic, they say, you don't have to worry, infant colic will go along, will go away. And some others, they say, no, you should address infant colic, and some infant formula were developed to manage infant colic. Do you think that's a relevant clinical endpoint, infant colics?
I think so. Well, on the other side, even if colic disappears at the age of 4 or 5 months, if an infant cries for 3-4 hours a night, I think you're very happy as a mother if you have a solution, if that baby cries less. So we should not neglect the impact of colic on the quality of life of the baby and that family. And any intervention that decreases that distress somehow is beneficial. And then we always say that colic disappears and it's only associations, but there is also a lot of literature which suggests that there is an association between infant colic and later developmental disorders such as autism, attention deficit disorders. Is that really true or not? We don't know for sure, but there are several trials. We at least suggest an association between both. Again, what we lack is any suggestion that intervention and decrease of colic does have an impact on that long-term negative outcome. If you treat colic and colic disappears more rapid, do you then have less autism in that group? No idea at all. So a lot of research there also needs to be done. But I think having a baby who cries 3 hours a day, if you can decrease that to 1 hour a day, it's absolutely good to do so.
And many, many clinical endpoints have been focusing on infections, antibiotics, prescription, allergies. Do you think that because taking into consideration that the first 2 years of life are very important for brain development, cognitive function, sociability, do you think that taking into account those endpoints it's okay? Do you think that they are being studied or they should be included in future studies?
Well, ideally, yes, but I think then it's of course multifactorial, and clinical trials which show an effect over several years are always very difficult to do. On the other side, there are certainly animal studies which show that microbiota composition does have an effect on brain development of those mice. So there seem, even on the anatomical structure of the hippocampus, so there seems to be a real relation between microbiota and brain development and development of cognitive function. There are trials in infants which shows association that the more bifidobacteria at the age of 1 year, the higher the cognitive development at age of 4 years. So, yes, but I think, so it's nice to include them. Having that as primary endpoint would probably need a lot of babies and difficult to do. But yes, of course, it would be very interesting to do so.
In terms of where you would like this field to go in the future, Ivan, we want to give you the final word. What would be your priorities?
Well, I think my priority would I would make it easy and show that with the addition of whatever biotic to my infant formula, I can have a positive effect on infectious disease and antibiotic prescription. That's, I think, relatively easy to do and also relevant because antibiotics disturb the gastrointestinal microbiota for a long term. So you might, if the less antibiotics needed in early life, the better. And we still do not have enough data to actively recommend to do so, to add those biotics then to that infant formula in order to really have that as demonstrated effect and as active recommendation.
Because we are dealing with the most vulnerable period, not only in the life of the infant, but also in the life of their microbiome.
Yes, absolutely. And the more an infant is sick, it all has impact on physical development, on faltering growth and whatever. So the less a baby is sick, the better it is lifetime long, because you have long-term negative consequences of diseases in early life.
And Ivan, knowing that bifidobacteria is the main group in this time, do you think that microbiota composition will ever be a trustable biomarker, or we are still far from saying, okay, we need those microbes?
Well, again, a good question. I think what is the evidence there is that, yeah, the more bifidobacteria, the better, which... If the exact strain of bifidobacteria is relevant or not, that's, I think, we still do not know, because we know that some strains of bifidobacteria only grow on those human milk oligosaccharides and that other biotics stimulate different bifidobacteria. But does that have a real clinical meaning and a clinical difference? Again, we do not know. So we have, I think there is a difference between microbiota composition and clinical efficacy. And of course, the closer we can get to the same microbiota composition, probably the better there is. But I'm not convinced that it is really necessary to have the same kind of strains of bifidobacteria. We need bifidobacteria. But today, to my opinion, literature suggest that whatever bifidobacteria, that's good. And maybe that one is a little bit better than the other, but that has not yet been demonstrated also.
Well, Ivan, our time is almost up. So I'd like to thank you very much for being with us today and certainly educating myself on these very important issues. And I know that our audience will really enjoy our conversation, and in particular, what you've got to say about the microbiome in infants, its vulnerability, and the difference between breast and formula fed infants, and how supplementation with biotics may have to alleviate these differences. So on behalf of ISAP, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you so much,
Ivan. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org, and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.